Well, ladies and gentlemen, it gives me great pleasure to introduce our last speaker. We've saved the best for last, is that right? We said that to Kelly, but we'll say it again for Greg here. Greg Fleming joins us as the CEO for the Maxim Institute, located in beautiful Auckland, New Zealand. The Maxim Institute is an independent research and public policy think tank committed to the people, land, history, and culture of New Zealand. The Institute works in a number of policy areas, including marriage and family, civil society, and government, as well as the need for personal character and responsibility. Greg co-founded Maxim with Bruce Logan when John Graham, then the Auckland University Chancellor, challenged him with a question that I think is really important and one that I think we should take to heart as well. The question was, what are you doing to shape the future of New Zealand? In our case, what are we doing to shape the future of Canada? I think that's a really important question. 10 years later, Maxim has been a significant influence and influential contributor to New Zealand's public policy debate. In 2005, Greg was one of six New Zealanders to receive a Sir Peter Blake Emerging Leader Award from the Sir Peter Blake Trust for his outstanding leadership. I think you'll see why in a few minutes. Maxim has also been the recipient of several awards, including three Templeton Freedom Awards for Institute Excellence, Social Entrepreneurship, and Initiative in Public Relations. He's also been a recipient of the Sir Anthony Fisher International Memorial Awards. We recognized a series that he'd called the Parents Factor in the Innovative Project category. He's here with his wife, Kirsty. Welcome, Kirsty. He's a father of five children, and it's my pleasure to welcome a friend, a colleague, and a fellow traveler on the policy road. Please welcome Greg Fleming.
Thank you very much. It really is fantastic to be here. I was getting excited for a moment. I thought you said you guys were all going to take on the challenge of asking what you can do for New Zealand. there's so few of us down there asking the question. That is leaning to the right, isn't it? But that's okay, as long as it's not leaning to the left. Okay, so I have photos. Can you see that? That is our five kids. It's a little red, isn't it? So we've got Toby on the left pulling her face, Willis, Annabelle, Harry, and then Jed. That's about a year ago, and it was taken at my wife's youngest sister's wedding. Kirsty's the second of five kids, and there's a big age gap between the oldest and the youngest. And Toby, pulling the face, was the page boy. And there he is there with his cousin. And I put these photos up there after Jonas showed photos of his family. I thought I'd better do the same. And then the reason I put that in there is because I remembered the reason I used that previous photo was this is the last decent family photo that we've got, even though it was taken like 13, 14 months ago. And it reminded me of the fact that day, Toby was so taken with the whole wedding ceremony that he took the wedding planner aside, the person who was managing the church, and said to her quite earnestly, was he able to bring Lily back and marry her in a few years' time at the same place? So he's getting the message of marriage. Now, to ensure that I do stay to time and make concisely the points that I want to make, I have actually drafted my talk out. So I prefer to speak more from PowerPoint slides, but in the pursuit of precision this afternoon, I will stay to my notes. I just wanted to say this is our first time to Ottawa. Kirsty and I have had the good privilege of being in Western Canada before, but we've never been to this city, and it's great to be in the capital of a fellow Commonwealth nation. Observing the 24-hour coverage by the US networks recently of the royal wedding, it's made me wonder if your southern neighbours are actually pining to be allowed back into the fold. I wouldn't suggest it. They brew lousy tea. Now, whilst New Zealand was one of the last British colonies to fully acquire independence, we were pretty slow off the mark on that one, we have often been at the forefront of change. In 1893, we were the first nation to give women the vote. In 1938, one of the first to introduce a comprehensive welfare state. In 1939, we were the first dominion to declare war on Germany. And in 1984, we were one of the first to declare a nuclear-free zone. We have a rapid history of uptake of new technologies, or a history of rapid uptake, indeed, of new technologies, facilitated in part by our small educated population, excluding, of course, the majority inhabitants, our 43 million sheep. They're cute and woolly, just not so smart. my pet lamb, Flopsy, excluded, of course. Now, there are just 12 universities, 2 news networks, 320 high schools, and 1 House of Parliament. Legislation passes very quickly, and new ideas ferment rapidly. When it comes to family life, this has meant some notable law changes have been forged in recent years, and that's what I'm to reflect on for the next half an hour. Specifically, I've been asked to speak to you about New Zealand's decriminalisation of prostitution in 2003 and the banning of spanking, or as we call it, smacking, as a form of child discipline in 2007. And whilst these two issues grabbed the headlines, there have been other less debated changes during that same decade that arguably have had a much greater impact on family life. For example, the Property Relationships Amendment Act of 2001 began to treat de facto relationships when they break up the same as marriage dissolutions. Now, like most law changes, it was trying to address some practical changes for individuals, but in the process it served to further encourage the view of marriage as just one relationship choice amongst many. The pragmatic decisions that we make in forming legislation will always have deeper origins and broader consequences than we tend to realise. I would suggest that underlying the legislative and policy changes that I wanted to discuss today is an idea that has long been shaping New Zealand's culture. And it is the notion of the free and isolated individual as the basic unit of our society, with consequently the family too often viewed as subservient or incidental to the individual. My colleague and good friend Paul Henderson spoke to the history of these ideas in his lecture to the inaugural IMFC conference in 2006. His excellent paper is available on the IMFC website. So I won't repeat that detail here, other than to note that the ideas of Rousseau, Kant, Dewey, Foucault and others have been absorbed deep into the New Zealand psyche and significantly shape our view of what it means to be human. And that view is the liberated, unrestrained individual free to create his or her own truth and to choose whatever he or she wants in pretty much any context. As part of our work, I often have the chance to speak with high schoolers and university students and explore with them the ideas and stories that underpin their approach to life. We use the term worldview or framework. I often note that if you want to hear clearly with ideas which ideas and beliefs most resonate with a society, then you need only tune into its advertisements. For a marketer's very existence depends on their ability to tap into the soul of potential consumers. And even a cursory glance at our screens will show which story most dominates. And so, given it is late in the afternoon, I have a couple of video clips that I would use with these high schoolers. The first is advertising an open polytechnic, a type of technical university in my home city of Auckland.
Your world was once a small one. As you grew, it did too. But now your world is bigger than it's ever been, and it has no boundaries. We are no longer limited by tradition, language, or distance. What was once fixed is fluid, and there's no one path. We work more jobs, learn more skills, and share more ideas than ever before. And we don't have to stop our lives to start new ones. When we understand this, our world is infinite. Everything's possible. Everything's open.
It's very compelling, very subtle, very, very appealing, and I enjoy unpacking some of its more nuanced messages. The second one is a little more bold, a little more amusing too. It's from Vodafone, which is one of the 3 main telecommunications companies that we have in New Zealand.
Isn't the world a great place? I mean, just think of all the things we can do now. You can change the colour of your hair, your skin, and even your eyes. You can have a virtual pet, an online friend, a second life. You can become a millionaire by selling pixels for $1 each. You can go back to school after you've retired. Men can stay at home and look after the kids, while women go to work and bring home the bacon. If you don't have boobs, you can just go buy a pair. You can dial a hubby. can get donuts in 564 different flavors and entertain the whole world from your living room. Now we can do all these great things, so let's make the most of it. Vodafone, make the most of now.
Okay, we could spend the whole day just on Vodafone adverts. They're absolutely fantastic in terms of the way that they read the culture and tap into this desire. Certainly, and I know that this is a desire that is common around the Western world, but one of my suggestions today is that it's particularly pronounced in New Zealand, and the reason I'm raising it is because I want to reflect on the role that has played in much of the legislative change that has happened in New Zealand over the past decade. Because I would suggest that it is this view of life where humans are atomised consumers and choices have few, if any, consequences. The second part is very important. That permeates and dominates every part of New Zealand culture, including family life. Several years ago, my younger sister Julie was travelling a very difficult road in her first marriage. The pressures of young children and a struggling business were sapping the life out of that relationship. She had very supportive neighbours, and our immediate family was offering a great deal of support. Practical, emotional, and financial. Those little platoons of support, the institutions of civil society, were responding just as they should. There were understandably many tough days, and my father and I would often receive calls from Julie where she would explain that the cupboard was literally bare. One day, instead of calling us, she took the advice of some friends and visited the local government welfare office. Work and Income New Zealand are there precisely for situations like this one, and they were eager to provide her with practical help. However, the manner in which they provided it was extraordinary. After hearing Julie's story, and obviously she was at a very low point that day, the welfare officer advised, "We're going to give you enough money so that you and your two sons can leave this marriage and set up your own life. You can then find someone who will make you happy." Julie noted to me later that it wasn't just the officer who was dismissive of marriage, that in a room full of brochures on how to negotiate divorce and single parenting well, there was not a single one on marriage counselling or keeping a family together. Not one. And the conditions around receiving the welfare benefits that flowed after that initial interview strongly echoed this approach. Julie and her husband quickly discovered that they would receive significantly more finance if he moved out of the family home, which he did. He would come back regularly and at times even stay over, but he needed to make his official residence somewhere separate from the family. The tax-paid welfare system was literally encouraging them to model separation, which of course soon became permanent. Now, given that benefits have to be income tested, I can understand practically how this situation has arisen, but the attitudes of both the office and the officer echo the prevailing assumption within our entire system, and that is that people consume relationships. That is their choice, there's nothing really wrong with it, and we need as a society only to alleviate any consequences. Yet as IMFC regularly publishes, and we've heard today, social science data overwhelmingly shows the very opposite. In fact, there's perhaps no other area in social science in which the evidence is so clear. Stable, enduring relationships matter enormously. Our choices do have profound consequences, particularly on our children. Now, in the paper I referenced earlier, Paul Henderson explains how the shift in ontology and epistemology has brought us to a place in New Zealand now where even the practice of objectively reading data is not free of contention. I recall being in a TV debate some years ago about the place and importance for marriage relationship. During a commercial break, one of New Zealand's leading professors in this area of work turned and said to me, "Greg, you refer frequently to the importance of family structure. Yet my recent meta-analysis shows that family form has virtually no impact on children's outcomes." I was speechless for quite some time. That was early on in my work at Maxim, and it was formative in shaping the manner in which I now engage in public debate in my country. Not for one moment have I given up on hard data. For example, one of our recent reports challenged and had some effect in encouraging the government to engage in more rigorous measurement of family intervention programs. Our claim was that they weren't measuring enough. They weren't taking the data seriously enough on the effect of these programs. But I am now realistic about the degree to which people's beliefs are shaped by experience far more than facts. Some of us were talking about this earlier this morning. It's fair to say that the most perplexing challenge for us as an organisation these past 10 years has been how to convince politicians and policymakers to accept a law or policy position that runs counter to their view of the world, of freedom, of justice and of compassion. And often, most fundamentally, their view of what it means to be human. And this challenge was particularly pronounced in the debate over prostitution. As indicated earlier, New Zealand decriminalised prostitution in 2003, and with Canada considering apparently a similar move, you are interested in hearing about the great Kiwi experience. Well, there is to date very little reliable data available on the impact of the legislation. As Brad said to us, it's taken 25, 30 years for us to fully understand the impact of divorce. I dare say it'll be the same on prostitution. In fact, in that case, Sweden has some far more established evidence in terms of their decriminalisation of Sweden 35 years ago. But we do have a lot of anecdotal evidence in New Zealand, of course, from both sides of the debate, which I'll refer to in a moment, along with some very recent polling done by a friend of mine just 2 months ago on New Zealand's attitudes to prostitution and how that is and isn't changing. But first, let me provide some history to the change and some reflections on the debate that ensued. Prior to the law change, prostitution was illegal but readily accessible. Under the Massage Parlours Act of 1978, brothels existed in practice but not in name. It was the police who effectively regulated the sector by exercising discretion as to when and where they would conduct raids on these parlours. Likewise, street prostitutes were committing a crime, but as long as they stayed in certain areas, the police would most often choose to turn a blind eye. When debates arose over the potential decriminalisation of prostitution, there were those who, because of this context, supported decriminalisation while not regarding prostitution as a desirable practice. They didn't see the act and industry of prostitution as inherently violent and dangerous. Rather, they believed that it was the absence of health and safety standards and access to employment rights that was the real problem. If we fixed those, then everything about the industry could be okay. There were, of course, other advocates who held a more radical view. They genuinely believed that prostitution was an industry where both workers and clients could conduct healthy and helpful transactions. They argued strongly that the negative aspects, the violence, the depression rates amongst prostitutes and the exploitation by gangs, were primarily the result of society stigmatising prostitution. The two MPs most vocally in support of the proposed law change regularly portrayed the industry as one where women could flourish and where clients could have their vital needs met in a healthy way. I remember one of the MPs proposing it saying that his vision was to see chains of brothels up and down New Zealand. I guess we're on the way to that. The bill decriminalising prostitution was introduced to Parliament in late 2000 and passed its first reading with a substantial majority. It made a slow passage through Parliament until the July 2002 election, after which the Select Committee and the new government processed final submissions and then recommended the bill to Parliament. It was in those final submission stages that we at Maximum Institute were invited to become involved. We had only existed as an organisation for 11 months, and the highly contentious nature of that bill thrust us into the headlines. It's interesting to look back on those days and think how different things might have been for us as an organisation for the last 9 years had that bill not been around. A year later, we found ourselves again in the spotlight as we debated then civil unions legislation. We were supportive of addressing anomalies in relationship law, but we opposed the further watering down of marriage. Of course, that nuance was overwhelmed by the emotion in the debate. Within a couple of short years, we found ourselves publicly defined by two very contentious and labelling issues. For the 6 years since then, we've worked almost entirely on education policy, foreign aid, constitutional matters, taxation, family support programs, and welfare policy. But often we're still defined by those two early years. And the reason I give this history is to make a couple of points. Firstly, for those individuals and organisations that are looking to engage in your looming prostitution debate, consider very carefully how and why you engage. And secondly, be aware of just how deep are the prior philosophical commitments of the groups who care about this issue. The understanding of the very nature of prostitution, what it assumes about humans, sex, choice, power, compassion, relationships and justice, is where the real debate needs to be had. Unfortunately, we seldom got to that ground in New Zealand. We certainly didn't get to that ground in our House of Parliament, where it was a last-minute impassioned speech by a transgender former prostitute MP that arguably swung the final few votes. She told a very personal story of being raped as a prostitute and being unable to go to the police because of the criminalisation of the industry. In that moment, the understandably emotional call for access to the criminal justice system trumped all other matters, including that of the much broader understanding of even justice itself. Two libertarian MPs, and interestingly New Zealand's first Muslim MP, were apparently swung by the speech, and the bill sneaked across the line, 60 votes to 59, with one abstention from the Muslim MP. As I mentioned earlier, although it is difficult to concretely measure, anecdotal evidence indicates that prostitution and the challenges of brothel locations, street workers and underage prostitutes have increased rather than decreased since its decriminalisation 7 years ago. New Zealand's model of law change effectively saw central government wash its hands of the problem, while at the same time tying the hands of the local government councils by giving them only the power to regulate where brothels can operate. In practice, this only means preventing them from operating in areas that are particularly sensitive. Subsequent court rulings, the courts have got very active on this one, have made it clear that local councils are not to use this regulatory power in any way to ban brothels. It is only there, they say, for the purpose of keeping them away, for example, being immediately in the vicinity of schools and churches. They say that suburban brothels is what they believe the government intended to be the norm when it passed this legislation. Understandably, the headaches are now numerous, including prevalence of street workers, battles over zoning of these residential brothels. Seldom does a month go by now without some headline detailing a brothel being found by a school gate or yet another local council wrestling with zoning challenges, not being able to do what it wants to do. One of the more recent high-profile cases was of a brothel setting up in the Prime Minister's neighbourhood. Another was the prevalence of street workers in Christchurch suburbs after the earthquake had shut the central city, including their usual pickup areas, and the outrage from the residents who were then, as they saw it, being invaded by the word they used, skanks. As part of the legislation, a review committee was established, and in 2008 it reported back to Parliament on the operation of the Act. 11 of the 12 government-appointed members were supporters of the law change, and hence, unsurprisingly, given my earlier observations about epistemological objectivity, they concluded that the law was working fantastically. Equally predictably, the 12th member, a friend of mine, formed a different view that was grounded in her experience as an outreach worker to street workers and her first-hand experience of the Act's effect. The police themselves commented in 2009 that they had observed an increase in street workers, including the number of underage prostitutes, and increased gang activity. Perhaps not surprising, given at the time of the law change, the president of the police association summarised his view as, and I quote, "the criminalisation means cops out, crims in." A couple of years ago, a friend of mine in the neighbourhood asked for some advice on how to deal with a brothel that had just set up on his street. He was sufficiently resourceful and networked to mobilise community pressure such that the brothel soon shut down. The same end usually meets most brothels that hit the headlines, but despite the law supporters' hopes that decriminalisation would change the community's attitudes, the majority of people retain the NIMBY approach, NIMBY being not in my backyard. Polling in March of this year had the following results. In answer to the question, should the prostitution laws be amended to specifically ban brothels in residential areas, 66 said yes and 26% no. And should street prostitution be banned, 50% said yes and no said 33%. The lowest support for such a ban was from males, and from those males and females aged 46 to 60, encouragingly, in terms of those of us who are still committed to seeing a law change in the future, and that is what Sweden has done after many years of having a legalised system. It has criminalised the johns, or those purchases. Encouraging for us, we see that 64% of males and females aged 18 to 30 supported a ban. So the next generation coming through seem to be more realistic about the damaging and the inherent destructive nature of prostitution. In Manukau City, the prevalence of street prostitutes in one of the main commercial and retail areas caused the council and local MP there to petition Parliament for extended powers. What they explicitly asked for was the right to ban prostitution in certain areas, and a bill to that end was introduced to our Parliament. With the recent merging of Manukau City into the other three cities that previously comprised the Greater Auckland area, the bill has been renamed the Auckland Bill, and has been ratified by the new council. Now, the council has to jump through some procedural hoops, but once they're clear, the bill will be back before our government's select committee, with deliberations scheduled to finish this September. If the bill is passed into law, then with such powers given to what is now, by some measure, New Zealand's largest district, it's very likely that similar powers will be sought by other councils around the country. In other words, I think this issue is very much still live. Like all such law changes, the majority of the proponents were, as I described earlier, well-intended. They believed that allowing women to freely make the choice of prostitution was the best way to assist them. But in that approach were two significant assumptions. Firstly, that the woman involved were genuinely making a free choice. And second, that the exercise of that choice would have no wider consequences on others or on society as a whole. I argued at the time, and I still do, that both of these assumptions are deeply flawed. Research is clear that for the vast majority of women, it is precisely a lack of choices and support that drives them into prostitution in the first place, and that the consequences of prostitution are considerable on the woman, on the buyer, and on the wider community. When a society decriminalises something, it is in effect saying that it no longer considers that activity to be problematic. That, I contend, is one of the reasons why we see more underage people going into prostitution. Sex is officially just another commodity to be traded, and there are no consequences attached. Such a move is consistent with what I previously observed regarding the elevation of self and choice above all other considerations in our society. But we're not always in such denial about the wider impacts of our private decisions. Ironically, this has all occurred at the same time that tobacco smoking has been very effectively hammered through continual legislative policy and taxation changes. As one commentator observed, it's now okay to buy sex, you just can't smoke afterwards. In closing this part of my talk, I would add that the inherently destructive nature of the sex industry isn't solved simply by resisting legislative change, any more than it's solved by decriminalisation or legalisation. Whenever law is offered as a thin solution to a real social problem, the challenge for those of us resisting that law is also to find ways to offer other forms of hope in the debate. This is obviously easier said than done, but it is an important road to walk. One example is a work that I have the privilege now of chairing in South Auckland. It's a charitable trust named Te Whaka Ora Tangata, translates from Maori, who are our Indigenous people, as a restoration of the people. And as its name suggests, it is informed by an anthropology that sees humans as relational, priceless, and redeemable. 2 months ago, we began working with a lady who has 14 children from different fathers and been a prostitute for over 25 years. She is now off the street and off methamphetamine, but only because she is now surrounded by a genuine community who are committed to her and her children's welfare and restoration. No amount of criminalising or decriminalising can affect such change.